Matter of Linda Brehm or Brehm versus Thomas Irwin. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes. Good afternoon, Judge. This is Gerald Clark with Clark Law Firm for the plaintiff appellant, Linda Brehm.
Good afternoon. Paul Hasmore from Cross Management on behalf of the respondent, Thomas Irwin.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Steve Foley Jr., Campbell Foley, Delano Adams on behalf of the experience.
Good afternoon, counsel, and welcome. We're going to try to get through Mr. Clark's argument and then take a break, half hour break, and resume with the additional arguments from this side of the table. Mr. Clark, please.
May I also request a brief rebuttal if necessary, no more than 5 minutes?
Yes.
And I thank the justices for accepting this petition for cert. This was an auto crash jury trial. There were essentially three claims made at trial. One was for the permanent life changes, permanent disability to Linda Brehm. The second was for wages. And the third claim that we were seeking in the case was for future medical expenses. In limine, we had moved to request that we be permitted to bring the claim for future medical expenses to the jury. So that was argued in limine. That was denied. The motion was denied, and the trial judge barred permitting us to present the claim for future medical expenses to the jury. We raised the issue again in connection with the charge conference the day before the actual jury charge, again with full briefing on the issue. The jury made its decision. It awarded monies for the permanent life changes, for the disability, and also for past wages. The jury didn't award anything for future lost wages. This court in the Haynes decision, the Haynes case involved a situation where it was also an auto crash trial where the PIP limits had been exhausted and there was uncompensated medical bills in that case. Those were all past medical bills. The appellate division in Haynes said that under the PIP statute, 39-6A-12, I believe is the number, that because the legislature did not explicitly permit in that statute to make a claim at trial for uncompensated past medical bills, the appellate division said that plaintiffs are permitted to make claims at trial under that statute for uncompensated past medical bills. This court accepted the case cert, and the New Jersey Defense Association submitted an amicus brief, and in that situation argued for strict construction of the statute. Because the statute did not explicitly permit making a claim for uncompensated past medical bills, that statute had to be interpreted strictly. This court essentially agreed that because the statute in question did not explicitly permit compensation for permit making a claim at trial for uncompensated medical bills, that the statute had to be read essentially strictly, that this court had to follow the legislature and barred plaintiffs in auto cases from making claims at trial for uncompensated medical bills in the PIP context, in that personal injury protection medical bills context.
Counsel, we don't blame you for jumping to the merits. The yes. Appellate division threw this out on mootness grounds. Would you like to start there?
I'm sorry, on which ground, Your Honor?
Mootness.
On mootness. So the appellate division never reached the issue of future medical bills because—
Mr. Clark, can I ask you a question on that very question of mootness?
Yes, Justice.
When did the plaintiff first make her intention to appeal known? My understanding is judgment was entered on July 7th. Plaintiff executed a warrant to satisfy the judgment on July 18th. And then on July 29th, for the first time, after she accepted the benefits of the judgment, made her intention to appeal known. Am I correct about those facts?
If I can just note one presentation on that regard that we disagree with. Mm-hmm. There's two judgments at issue here. In our view, there's only one judgment. So when Your Honor said she accepted the benefits of that judgment,
right?
We're not contesting nor appealing or challenging the benefits of that judgment, i.e. the jury verdict judgment. We're only contesting the judgment, the separate judgment, which is the trial decision to bar future medical bills. Everything else that Your Honor said is correct.
Well, let me just focus on that for a minute. If we're talking, so then if we are talking about the judgment of pain and suffering, the one that was actually entered on July 7th and was the subject of the warrant, the executed warrant to satisfy the judgment, her intention to appeal was made known after those two things, right?
The only judgment she's appealing is the judgment of the trial judge barring future medical bills.
I understand that's your position, but yes. I want to make sure that I understand that her intention to appeal was made known after the warrant to satisfy the judgment was entered.
That is incorrect.
Okay.
And the appellate division got that wrong.
Okay, explain why.
Okay, so the appellate division... it's smack on point. It's the second sentence of the opinion. Quote, because plaintiff filed a warrant to satisfy judgment under Rule 4:18-1, we dismiss the appeal as moot. Number one, plaintiff did not file the warrant to satisfy the judgment. The defendant did on August 8th, 2022,
right.
9 days after we submitted the letter to the court requesting the order so that we could file an appeal of the medical expense issue.
When did the plaintiff accept the benefits of the pain and suffering judgment? Before or after she made her intention to appeal known?
I do not recall, as I sit here, and I do not believe the record reflects when the defense sent the check.
I think it's July 18th, before July 18th, that she accepted a check of $311,435.59 before July 18th of 2022. And then on July 29th, so more than 11 days later, she notified Judge Wilson that she was attempting to file an appeal regarding the barring of her claim for future medical expenses.
Correct. And it's, I don't know if
she accepts the money first. There's more than $300,000 that is transferred to her, correct?
Yes. It's not, I don't know if I can say it, but it remained in our trust account throughout the pendency of the appeal, actually. But okay. that's the equivalent of the plaintiff receiving it, however, because it's client monies, it happens to be in our trust account.
And at the time, she didn't say, I can't accept this money because I want to appeal.
In reliance on this court's decision in Gaccio, no, she did not.
In Gaccio, the person had already filed a notice of appeal before they accepted any money. We're talking about Adolf Gaccio, Inc., correct?
Correct.
So as far as I can tell, she filed a cross appeal in that case. The plaintiff, I'm sorry, filed a cross appeal in that case on April 19th, 1957. And then on May 16th, while the appeal was pending, the defendant paid the amount due. So the plaintiff accepts the money after filing the notice of appeal.
Okay. But in that situation, the court found that because the claims are separate and would only increase the amount of the judgment, that it is permissible to do that.
So let me just, okay.
Actually, that's not what the court said, though, Counselor. What the court said is that because what you're talking about is directly related only to that sum and not a separate claim, it can go ahead. So Gaccio has a second part of this, which is the reference to, quote unquote, that sum. And in that case, there was an offset. And the only question was that whether that sum, that offset, would stay the same or increase. So there wasn't a question about a separate claim. In fact, wouldn't you agree that future medical expenses and giving future medical expenses would impact the underlying character of the judgment, as opposed to just be related to one, the exact same claim, and whether that claim could move up or stay the same?
Justice Hoffman, it's our position that the future medical bills question is an entirely distinct claim. It has an entirely distinct jury charge. It can be awarded or not without affecting the disability or the wages claim. It's entirely separate and distinct.
And if that's true, then doesn't Gottscho hurt you instead of help you? Because Gottscho is saying that the only thing that will allow to happen is that the specific damages at issue, the offset at issue in Gottscho, could move. It could be adjusted upward or stay the same. What Gottscho's not saying is that you can include a completely separate type of damage that would affect or impact the underlying character of the judgment. Gottscho's saying, we'll let you look at one thing. We'll let you look at the offset and whether it should move up or stay the same.
I think when we talk about, I think that what the courts have done, and there's only one Supreme Court case on this issue, but there's two appellate division cases, or three appellate division cases. With respect to the Sturvidient case, which is the appellate division case from 1971, that was a workers' compensation case where both parties agreed this is the workers' compensation award. The warrant to satisfy was filed for the complete award. At some point during, in close proximity to that time, the law had changed and another decision came down with respect to how to calculate an award for a heart attack at work. And what they needed to do, because it directly involved the calculation of that claim, they had to claw back or pull back the warrant to satisfy judgment and essentially redo it. So I think in that context, the fact that the future medical bills claim is completely separate and does not in any way affect the calculation of the judgment for disability and wages helps. And it was also, if I may, Justice Fischel, it was also in the Tassi case, which was the divorce case. It was also the problem that they were trying to tweak or change the amount that was inherently intermingled, which was for, I don't do family law, so I'm not terribly conversant in it, but what was for the alimony and maintenance and support, and they wanted to tweak those numbers. And because they were going to tweak those numbers, which could make it go down, that is where the appellate division ruled. I think the Gottscho case, similar to the guarantee insurance case, the guarantee insurance case involved it was an underlying malpractice case, and it was a question about fee shifting because the attorney and the law firm had to defend the malpractice case on their own. And the lower court awarded the fee shifting for that. And the other thing the law firm plaintiff also wanted, or I suppose it would be the defendant in a declaratory judgment action, what they also wanted was fees for defending the DJ action or prosecuting the DJ action. And because they were separate, and the fees on the DJ action would have zero impact on the fees already recorded in the judgment for defending the malpractice, it was permissible. So I think the fact that the future wages is entirely separate and apart helps.
You say that it's separate, but the trial court said it in its decision to exclude future medical expenses from the jury's consideration, the actual judgment that's being appealed or decision that's being appealed here, that the jury's future need for medical treatment is admissible insofar as it goes to the issues of pain, suffering, and loss of enjoyment of life. So the judgment reflected, when it went to the jury, what the jury assessed would be the future condition of this plaintiff, did it not?
We don't, Justice Patterson, we don't know obviously what the jury did. But it is correct that Judge Wilson below said the jury can still hear about the need for future treatment as it relates to the pain, suffering, disability, loss of enjoyment. But permitting the future medical bills would have zero impact on those. So what we are.
But the jury did decide, I guess, I mean, juries are presumed to be doing what they're told to do. What is the level of medical care that this individual will need in the future? Let me ask you this: if you prevailed on the issue of mootness and it went back for and on a remand, and the trial court said these issues are so intertwined, the issues that were decided by the jury and this question, which you're contending is totally separate. If the trial court said these issues are so intertwined, I'm going to have a new trial on damages in its entirety so that a jury can assess damages. Would that be an abuse of discretion?
Yeah, well, 100%. Justice Patterson, the jury already found that it was a verbal threshold. She had to prove a permanent injury. Right. The jury already found that she suffered a permanent injury. The jury already found that she had past lost wages. The jury may or may not have considered her pain and suffering award the future medical treatment she may have to endure. We don't know, but they were permitted to do that.
But pause there for a second. If they may have considered that, is it theoretically possible the award could be reduced if you went back for additional proceedings on future medical expenses?
No, because we don't know if the jury, in fact, compensated for future medical care, pain, and suffering.
But isn't that part of the problem, that you may be repudiating part of what has already taken place up until now?
Well, we wouldn't, because we are requesting a remand to the trial court for a trial limited to the issue of future medical bills. That jury may award future medical bills, or the jury may not. Either one of those decisions would have zero impact on a prior jury having awarded monies for pain and suffering and lost wages.
But when you prove future medical, a need for, when you prove future medical expenses, part of the premise of your proofs have to be that she will need the future medical expenses, correct?
She'll probably need, yes.
And so didn't this jury, within the scope of how the trial court said that it would charge the jury and did charge the jury, make a determination as to what her future injury, her future pain and suffering and other aspects would be?
Yes, the jury did make an assessment of that, but we don't know what their findings are because it's just an award for pain and suffering. But the fact of the matter here is that Linda Bream was denied making a claim for future medical expenses, a wholly uncompensated loss, based on applying the old statute that was changed in response to this court's urging the legislature change it. The trial court applied the old statute. The defense throughout the appellate process has cited the old statute.
But that's the second part of your argument. We're dealing here with respect to mootness, with the relationship or lack thereof between the judgment that that she collected money on and what you characterize as a different judgment, which I'm not sure it's a different judgment, but a decision by the trial court that led in part to the judgment that she collected on.
We are not attacking that judgment. We are not attacking the jury verdict sheet. We are not attacking anything that was the subject of the warrant to satisfy. We are simply attacking the judgment of the trial court.
That's not it. Was that a judgment? That was a motion to exclude evidence, an in limine decision, an interlocutory decision.
Well, I think it's fair to use court orders, decisions, and judgments simultaneously in this context, or synonymously in this context.
I mean, it was an order. I'm not sure it's fair to say that you had two different judgments, because when you get to the point where you have a right to appeal, you've got to certify to the court, to the appellate division, that this is a final judgment that resolves all issues as to all parties.
Okay, but Socratically asking myself, number one, where is the prejudice in all this? What is the policy that we are trying to achieve here? Because look at what happened in this situation. And I was thinking about this as I was sitting here. Let's say someone from the building and grounds department here says, hey, we got to reupholster these four chairs. Okay. And then they say, but wait a minute, the three chairs are fine. It's really the one chair that needs to get reupholstered. And then we say, yeah, but we're only going to, if the one chair needs it, but in order to address that one chair, we got to reupholster all four chairs.
With great respect, Mr. Clark, I'm not sure that works.
Oh, but here's the thing. Here's the public policy situation that I'm articulating. In this situation, first of all, the court rules provide parties 45 days to give notice and announce whether or not they're going to appeal. The warrant to satisfy judgment rule, I believe it's rule 4:48, has nothing in there about, oh, you need to put an asterisk and say we may appeal these things. So what is the policy that's being achieved here? Essentially, what the defense is advocating for is that a party needs to announce, instead of reupholstering the three chairs or getting rid of the three chairs that don't need reupholstering and focus on the one, we need to announce and invite everyone to appeal all issues instead of putting to bed the three issues that were properly put to bed in this case.
I respectfully, the warrant, there's no requirement that you collect the money if you're going to file an appeal. And the warrant to satisfy judgment is simply an acknowledgement. I have collected the money on this judgment.
Correct.
So I just don't see where that takes you because in general, the warrant to satisfy judgment is an announcement that the case is over.
No, that the judgment has been satisfied, but the Gotcho case and Stubbe didn't.
No, but again, Sturby, in Gotcho, the person filed a notice of appeal before accepting the money. Has there ever been any case where someone accepts money without filing a notice of appeal beforehand and is still permitted to appeal?
Accepts money. I'm sorry, Justice Wayne Appner. Sorry.
Okay. Thanks. So in Gotcho, the plaintiff accepts the money only after filing the notice of appeal. Notice of appeal filed next month accepts the money. So the person knows that when she accepted the money, or he, I'm not sure, that was not, that the person was still appealing because the notice of appeal had been filed, I think, 3 or 4 weeks before. Is there any case in which someone has been allowed to take money without having filed a notice of appeal and then all of a sudden, after taking the money, say, but I want to appeal?
I think the guarantee insurance case had similar facts, where they accepted the fees for fee shifting on the underlying legal malpractice case, but went ahead and appealed the failure to award fees for prosecuting the declaratory judgment action.
Could you give me the citation for that? Sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. It is 217 Super 604. Appellate Division 1987.
But what didn't that involve two separate actions?
They were consolidated. There was an underlying legal malpractice case, but for purposes of litigation and trial, the insurance coverage actions were consolidated. Both you should have defended me, insurance company, and you should pay for my fees and having to prosecute the claim against you as a first party insured.
That was a distinct claim. That was a completely distinct claim that they were separately going to be pursuing. Right here, you agree that if the future medical expenses had been permitted, that the jury could have resolved all of it together and could have found permanent injury, but found a lesser amount in damages to account for the amount that she would be getting in future medical expenses, for example. So it could have potentially reduced the amount that they were providing to the plaintiff based on the full calculation of she's getting future medical expenses, so we're going to lower the amount she's getting on permanent disability.
So Justice Noriega, theoretically, anything can happen when the jury room doors close, but that would be violating the jury charges because
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have the jury charges right here.
Yes.
The charge on the pain and suffering requires the jury to consider the nature, character, and seriousness of any injury, discomfort, or disfigurement. They could also consider age, occupation, family responsibilities, similar relevant facts, condition, health before and after the accident. And they have to do so even considering whether the harm and loss goes into the future. The charge on the future medical expenses claim require the same thing. You have to consider in deciding how much to award on future medical expenses, the nature, extent, and duration of the plaintiff's injury. You'll have to consider the age, the general state of health, and how long you reasonably expect the medical expenses to continue. It seems like they're pretty interrelated to me, but I do want to get to some questions about the second argument that you have, specifically about the amended collateral source rule. But do we agree that the charges themselves are pretty similar on pain and suffering and future medical expenses?
There's, yes.
Okay.
But may I, yes.
Yeah, that's the only point that I really wanted to make. I want to talk about this PIP carrier.
Sure. You can expand on the answer if you wanted to. Go ahead, and then we'll move on to the second issue.
Thank you, Justice Ravner. So Justice Fischel, the answer is yes. On pain and suffering, the jury is invited to consider the harm into the future. No question about that. But they are not to consider awarding a dollar amount for future medical bills under that. And in fact, this jury was specifically told, I believe at least once, if not twice in the jury charge, you are not permitted to award a dollar amount for future medical bills. It's a dollar amount. I mean, it's justice. There's a bit of injustice in this situation that is permitted to exist by this mootness finding of the appellate division. And the injustice is that there's an uncompensated medical loss here that this court urged the legislature to revisit, which the legislature did only 8 months later.
That's what I want to get to.
But we're putting plaintiffs in an impossible situation here, number one. And the situation is that, take Linda Bream. The record reflects she would have lost her house, okay, if she didn't, and that was very different in the Tassie case. Tassie, the estate was worth $2.5 million in the 50s. And the appellate division made the point in that case of denying.
Wasn't it this 1970s? I think it was 76, Tassie.
Right. But I believe that the divorce was in the 50s. The point is $2.5 million was a gazillion dollars at that time. And what was key to the appellate division in that case is that Miss Tassie, who had been abandoned by Mr. Tassie, who was very successful, made a lot of money, could afford to sustain herself throughout the time of the appeal. The court specifically noted that she was able to prosecute the appeal. In this situation, because this is this, you know, we have to consider public policy and fundamental notions of fair play and substantial justice in this court. If Ms. Bream was pressed on the impossible situation of saying, you know what, I'm not going to take any of this money, okay? I'm gonna roll the dice. I'm going to invite the insurance company to do all their cross appeals and have all these issues. First of all, it's a time of judicial shortage. Number two, she may well have lost her house. She needed to take the money during that time. She needed to take the money of that judgment to go after the medical bills. Otherwise, you're putting the person in an impossible situation of risk your house or forgo the medical bills. It's just not fair. And the court and number one, number two, in terms of public policy and fundamental justice and practicalities here, you're inviting multiple appeals. You're inviting cross appeals. You're inviting the defense to say, oh, the money, it was a new trial on all issues. Why would we want to do that? And I don't think that's consistent with the Supreme Court and Gotcha. And it's true.
But let justice- me ask you something, because you talk about the relationship, and I want to go back to the question I asked you before. This is a practical matter. Wouldn't a trial court have been within its rights in ordering a new trial on all issues because of the issue that Justice Fischelli raised with you, and that is the relationship between the inquiries of that prior jury and the inquiries that were going to be undertaken by a future jury?
Justice Patterson, I would answer that question no, because the first jury was not permitted to award a dollar amount for medical bills. It was not permitted to. And we don't know if the jury threw some money in there for future treatment or a surgery in terms of the pain and suffering aspects, but we're not addressing the pain and suffering. We're not seeking to increase a pain and suffering award, unlike Ms. Tassie, who was seeking to increase the dependency and support award.
You may not seek to do that, but how can we be certain the jury itself might not have chosen to?
Okay, let's assume hypothetically the jury awarded some money for the pain and suffering aspects of future medical treatment. That wouldn't affect the future medical bills treatment. Or it wouldn't affect the future medical bills because the bills are what the bills will be. Or
arguing that a jury has to be taken to follow the court's instruction, and here it was instructed multiple times that it could not award any money for future medical expenses.
My recollection is as at least twice Justice Wiener Apner. Yes. And to address Your Honor's question earlier about the timing and Gottschall before versus after, I would say, what does it matter? Because the fact of the matter is, in both scenarios, whether or not the money is accepted before or after the warrant is filed, what does it matter? Because
It's not about whether the money is accepted before or after the warrant is filed. It's about whether the money is accepted before or after the notice of appeal is filed. You appeal first and then accept the money, in which case the defendant knows that even though you accepted the money, you're still appealing because you already filed a notice of appeal. Or do you accept the money, which could make the defendant think that you are not appealing because you just accepted the money, and then try to file a notice of appeal? That's what I was asking, not about when the warrant to satisfy the judgment is filed.
In this situation, we filed two letters with the court, the first being 9 days before the defendant filed the warrant to satisfy judgment.
It was after the money had been accepted. That was my point.
But it was accepted in the sense of a satisfied judgment, not in terms of a settlement or an offer and acceptance and the case is over. There's nothing in the warrant to satisfy rule that says the case is over if a warrant to satisfy is filed. There's no case that says if you accept judgment, judgment monies, that any other issues, it's over. This is not a settlement. This is not a offer, acceptance, settlement situation. This is a warrant to satisfy. And these issues are perhaps more appropriate for the Rules Committee. If the Rules Committee wanted to engraft a rule into the warrant to satisfy that says, by the way, if you file a warrant to satisfy, you're forgoing everything else, any other issues, I feel that would be a draconian kind of situation, but that would be a more appropriate for the Rules Committee. It's our position.
And I think it seemed you were going to say that in both this case and Gottschall, there was still time left on the 45 days to appeal at the point at which plaintiff filed a notice of appeal.
Yes, Pierre-Louis. There is Justice Pierre-Louis. Yes, there's no hiding the ball here. We made clear, we objected to this ruling on the medical bills issue, and going back to Justice Fasal's question, it was because they applied we don't care that the legislature changed the statute at the Supreme Court. We're still going to apply the old one because I have a fundamental disagreement with future medical bills, because then everyone will request this. It will be speculative. There was no hiding the ball here on any of that. We told them we filed two letters before they filed the warrant to satisfy the judgment. The appellate division also got it wrong on that issue because they said, here, plaintiff never advanced either on the record or in writing that she intended to pursue her claim for mutual medical expenses after the judge's in limine ruling. That is not reflected in the record here. The record reflects we made it clear at the charge conference with a brief on the issue. We sent two letters before the warrant to satisfy was filed and before the notice of appeal was filed.
What did you do, if anything, to let the defendant know that before they wrote your client a check, which you have in your trust account appropriately or had, what did you do to notify the defendants that this case is not over? We're going to appeal that issue on the future medical expenses. Before the signature, before the actual transaction occurred, and that is check is paid, the check is handed over, and the warrant to satisfy judgment is executed.
Okay, we did nothing to notify them, to answer Your Honor's question directly. We relied upon Rule 2:4-1 that gives us 45 days to so notify them. That's why this goes back to the Rules Committee situation. There is nothing in Rule 2:4-1 that gives you 45 days to determine that and make that announcement.
That's just the rule that tells you 45 days to appeal. It doesn't deal with, and in most
notice
cases,
of appeal, notice.
Notice tell of them. Appeal. And in most cases, people are not getting a check during that 45 days. So what was unusual here is that there was a judgment that was paid on.
For three chairs, but there was still one chair left over, which was the future medical bills.
Let's pause for a second. Are there other questions relating to mootness? Then it's 10-1. I want to be fair to staff and make sure everybody gets a lunch break. We're going to pause now. We'll be back in 30 minutes. We'll move on to the second issue, wrap that up, and then turn to Mr. Massey.